Order! Design!
Hello and welcome to Episode 9, the All Art Edition of Notes from the Aisle Seat.
Attention!
The podcast that covers the arts in Northern Chautauqua County, sponsored by the 1891 Fredonia Opera House. My name is Tom Laughlin. And I'm your host as we bring you news and information about arts events at the Opera House and around the region, as well as interviews with artists and creators across the county. Today's episode focuses on three visual arts events happening in the coming 2 weeks. First, we'll visit with artist Audrey K. Dowling, the proprietor of the Portage Hill Art Gallery outside Westfield, New York, and talk about the $10,000 grant she just received from the New York State Council on the Arts, a significant award for an individual artist. For the upcoming Art and Architecture series documentary coming up on January 22nd at the Opera House, I'll be joined by distinguished professor of art Alberto Rey for a discussion on the Impressionist era. Finally, Hyla Stellhorn, the gallery coordinator for the Marion Art Gallery, talks about an independent exhibition she has installed at the Patterson Library in Westfield, featuring the work of student and faculty designers from the Department of Theater and Dance at SUNY Fredonia. So we're going all out in this all art episode of this podcast. Born and raised in Chautauqua County, with a little bit of time spent in New York City for good measure, Audrey K. Dowling has been creating a myriad of artworks in all kinds of media, from painting to clay to stoneware. Her connection to nature runs deep throughout all her work, and for the past 40 years she has run the Portage Hill Gallery just outside Westfield, New York. The New York State Council on the Arts recently awarded her a $10,000 grant for her project Finding Truth, about the natural beauty of Western New York. I spoke to her about the grant and her career as a visual artist. It's great to get Audrey Dowling on as a guest. Audrey, thanks for coming on, and I appreciate it.
Thank you for asking me. Happy to be here.
Yeah, good. Let's talk first about this New York State Council on the Arts Award. It's quite a significant award, and you must be pretty thrilled to get it.
I am beyond thrilled to get it. I just feel really honored, and it's sort of validation for me too. I've been working for a long time, and being Western New York artist, a rural artist, we tend to not be looked at as much as some of the urban artists are. So yeah, it's a very large honor. And it was also this time the Arts Service Initiative out of Buffalo worked with artists for the first time to sort of be a mediary uh-huh. and help read what you were submitting. And she liked what I was submitting. There really was nothing that she corrected. But, you know, I think that may have helped too. But yeah, it's so great to have Western New York artists getting some recognition.
Do you have any a specific thing you're going to do, activity or work that you're going to create with the money you got?
Yeah, this coming year, actually, I have two sort of neat things happening. I have a one-woman clay show in Iowa that a collector of mine had shown my work to a curator out there, and the curator got in touch and wondered if I would be interested in having a one-woman clay show in Pearson Art. Pearson Lake Art Center. I have heard I'm the first woman clay artist that they have focused. So wow. That's fun too. And then the other thing was that I also have, this is our 40th year of running the gallery, so I was going to do some special thing for my work, and I have a one-woman show coming up in Buffalo in the fall in the Book Arts Gallery in downtown Buffalo. And I thought, well, I'll focus on one of those or the other for this grant, and I chose to focus on the mixed media pieces, and so that's what I sort of have written the grant for, to help me with the time and stuff of getting ready for the show, which will be first here in the gallery, sort of celebrating our 40th year of existence. And then I'm going to travel it to Buffalo. So it'll be mixed media, block print combo. I'm also have some ideas in mind that are three-dimensional as well as two-dimensional. So I'm taking it a step further. I've done a little bit of that, but I'm going to go even further with that, going deeper.
Great, great. That's wonderful. I'm very thrilled for you. Again, congratulations. It's great. Let's talk just a little bit about, you know, how you came to be, you know, your artistic path. I know you seem to have been interested in art ever since your undergraduate days at New Paltz, and you've just gone on from there.
Actually, it goes younger than that. I was raised on 52 acres outside of Bemis Point, Ellery Center area. We had the Bemis Creek ran right through our property, and it had two side chutes on it too. So we basically, in essence, had three creeks, one larger and two little ones. And I spent my life in those creeks. And of course, in the banks of creeks in Chautauqua County, there is clay.
Yes.
So my sister and I would dig out that clay and make things. And I didn't have any way to fire it. I just let it air dry, painted it with paint that... no durability whatsoever, but you know, that wasn't a part of it. I mean, the process was part of it. So I had that. And then also as a child, my dad was an engineer. He was a hobby farmer. We had a barn full of tools I had total access to. And from very young, I was always out there putting things together. And, you know, there was all, you know how barns are.
Oh yeah.
I mean, there's all kinds of goodies you can extricate to make things with. So I started very young making things and liking things and drawing. I was a typical young kid who loved female, who loved drawing horses. Mm-hmm. You know, that's still somewhat typical. And so that's where I first started. Then I sort of always loved taking art through school. I was in an advanced situation in Jamestown, and so they told me that I could not fit art into my schedule when I was in high school. And because I was advanced, I had made some sort of deal that I would take advanced courses all the way up through. So I said to my guidance counselor, I didn't make any deal. I don't know that deal. And that I really need art because I want to go into art. Got to get a portfolio together. Mm-hmm. So she saw the wisdom of that. So she broke me out of a few of the courses I would have otherwise had to have so that I could take art courses. So that I took that. And then I also went and took at JCC, I took a drawing course with Cecil Rhodes, who used to live in Bemis Point, well-known local artist who's no longer alive. And really my portfolio was all put together on the work I did in his class, his drawing class at JCC. And so then I applied to New Paltz. In the meantime, when I was in my junior year, my parents moved to New York City. So I had gone down with them with thoughts of going to a college or high school in New York City. Teacher strike year didn't happen, but I was down every summer, every vacation, and I was too young really to work. So I would ride the subway every day, mm-hmm. get back before my parents got home from work and go to a different section of New York, see a lot of galleries, a lot of museums, just New York life. Was right. Very interesting to me. That was in 68 and 69. Mm-hmm. Pretty exciting times down there. 67, 68, and 69. You wouldn't want to be in Times Square back then, but.
Oh, I was. I grew up down there.
All right. So you know what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
And crazy. And so that was fun. That was a lot of fun. And that really, I don't know, my parents were British. My father had been at sea for 15 years and knew the world. My mother was very well read. Not afraid of anything. And so I sort of approached my whole New York adventure with that idea in mind. And they let me. I mean, parents now would never let you take off on
They never would. My father and mother were the same way. I mean, when I was 16 and 17, I thought nothing of hopping onto the Long Island Railroad and going into Manhattan for a day and spending time, you know, wandering around wherever I wanted to go, and then just catching a night train home.
Yeah, it was so alive, wasn't it? It was a very alive time.
Yes, it was.
So that kind of played in. And my parents kind of wanted me to go to a New York City school because they lived in New York at the time and wouldn't have cost them any money. But I thought I wanted to be an art teacher. And my two choices were, at that time — it's different now — at that time were Buff State or New Paltz. Mm-hmm. And Buff State was going to be Western New York to me. And I felt like I sort of squeezed all the influence I needed out of Western New York. And so I had set my sight on New Paltz. Mm-hmm. New Paltz was very hard to get into, but hallelujah, I got in. Good. And so from there, it, you know, that sort of blossomed, and I've always loved art. And so I just went that direction.
Yep. And there you are.
There I am.
You know, I looked at your work is so vibrant. I look through the galleries at some of your mixed media stuff and your paintings and things like that. And some of them, you know, I can see an impressionist influence a little bit on some of the paintings. Some of the starkness and the black and whites and the vibrant colors. Do you have artists, particular artists that inspired you to go in those kinds of directions?
Well, I think that, you know, any artist who's done a lot of looking in galleries and reading — one of my hobbies is to read about the lives of artists. Mm-hmm. I love artist biographies. And I spend a fair amount of time — I don't go anywhere if there's an art gallery around the world, I don't go through it. And I think that it just sort of all melds in there with life experiences. And I try to keep my life experiences interesting. Do a lot of travel, spend a lot of time in the woods, as you probably saw in my work.
Oh, yes. Yeah,
right from childhood. I was a bird watcher from high school on. All those influences all coming together. And I think, you know, some of the artists, though, whose work I resonate with me is — I like the Group of Seven out of Canada for painting, very painterly. I was schooled in painterly painting. Uh-huh. Some people now do very dry-looking painting to me, very realistic. You can't feel the paint so much when you look at the piece, but I was definitely taught to make — you could feel the paint
right
when you looked at the painting. So that's probably why the Group of Seven is appealing to me. And then Emily Carr is really appealing to me. Uh-huh. And she's a Canadian. And are you familiar with her work?
No, I'm not.
Okay. Well, she actually lived a very interesting life. They said if there had been, like, the Group of Seven had eight, she probably would have been number eight.
Right.
But they didn't have any women, of course. That's not a new story.
Right.
And I actually had always sort of known about her, found her intriguing and interesting. And then we were out traveling in near Seattle, and we went over to, took the ferry right over into Canada, and in there, museum right there, there was a whole Emily Carr show. And it included — she painted from a caravan, which we would call a camper.
Right.
And they had set up in the museum her caravan and her whole little setting that she would take out. And she was never married. She was a character. I mean, she was definitely different. Mm-hmm. And she would ride the mail boats up into the Haida territory. And she got in her mind that she wanted to document the totem poles and the Haida culture before it was not there anymore.
Ah, yes. I've seen a lot of Haida art because my daughter lives in Washington State.
Okay. Well, look up Emily Carr.
I will.
She's very painterly, again, a person who's very painterly. She's just like some of the other Group of Seven. She's right in the edge between realistic and abstract.
Yes.
Which is the zone I love to play in.
Yes.
You wouldn't necessarily — looking at my work, you wouldn't necessarily see the direct connection, but the mindset of going and doing your own thing and just getting out there and just living your life and not worrying, mm-hmm, what the outcome is, you just do it.
And right.
So far, I'm getting pretty good outcomes, so I'm not too displeased.
No, I'd say you're doing fine, Audrey. Now you mentioned that it's the 40th anniversary of the Portage Hill Gallery. That place has been around for a long time. I passed it several times, and I have to be honest with you, I've never walked in. I should. But tell us how that got started, and how you've managed to keep it going all these years in such a, well, you know, let's call it a rural location, shall we?
Okay. Yeah. Well, I first got involved with the art community here. We left the Hudson Valley. We had a house right on the Hudson River, which actually was part of the John Burroughs original estate. Oh. And people actually couldn't believe we left it, but we did. We sold it and we left it because out here we had 83 glorious acres waiting for us. It had waterfalls, a killer view of Lake Erie, woods, everything you can imagine. And it was right when I was starting my family and had my sons and my family was out here. I kind of wanted to be near them. And it was also in the back to land movement. Remember the back to land movement?
I remember the back to land movement.
All right. So we built a cottage on that beautiful piece of property. We didn't have a running water. We didn't have electricity. And so we heated with wood solely. And so I couldn't do clay. So I went back into doing block prints. And I did a bunch of block printing on fabric and combining things. I've always been somebody who's not been afraid to do the unusual and just, but I don't feel compelled to do the unusual. I just do it. You know what I mean?
Yes.
I don't set out saying, oh, I'm going to do something different than anyone else ever. I just go where my muse takes me. And my muse is different than every, you know, if you really look for your artist voice, you are going to be different from anybody else because you're just as a writer has their own writer's voice, artists have their own artist voice if they will reach in and do the work to find it.
Right. And develop it.
Right. Yep. And so what the way the gallery came to be, while we were living in the cabin, I was also involved with the Westfield Artist Co-op. And I was their director of education. Right then. So it became Adams Gallery and it moved up to Dunkirk. And you probably know the history after that.
Yes.
But at any rate, I was putting classes together. And while I was there, I was thinking, you know, I go and do these shows and there's a bunch of artists, local artists in these shows. And they say to me, well, you know, they get into great shows. And they would say to me, but we can't sell our work locally. We don't even try. So I thought, I wonder if we could put together some sort of guild that is the purpose is trying to build a local market. So I put something in the paper about it and wondered if anyone would show up to a meeting. Well, it just so happened that Kevin Mathers and his wife, Marcy, who was a really good potter, came, thought it was a great idea, thought we should go for it, and felt that we could probably get a show at Chautauqua. And he wanted to work on it. So and there were a couple others that showed up, but he was the most important one. He took that idea and really ran with it. And so there were four of us that met about every week or every other week in each other's studios. And we laid the plans together and that became the Chautauqua Crafts Alliance, which has the two juried shows on Bester Plaza every summer ever since then. But so we got that going. And then I thought, boy, we really could use a gallery out here where there's year-round representation for our regional artists, many of whom get into amazing shows and nobody locally knows it. So that's how it came to be. We sold our property, which broke my heart. But anyways, we sold our property, bought the gallery because it was more accessible. Was on Route 17 at that time.
Right.
But, you know, so there was heavy traffic by it.
Yes.
86 was not a figment of anyone's imagination right then. And that's how it all got started. And so I invited people that I knew, whose work I knew that I wanted to have here. And it sort of worked that way. People now contact me. But once I retired from teaching, I have more and more of my own work. So I have less and less space for other people. So I still do carry several other people's work. I have some artists that have been with me almost all 40 years.
Wow. Well, it's a great service. I know it's a great service for regional artists. And, you know, I think there are things that are out there. So we hope we can get them a little bit more publicity and get the word out a little bit more that there's really some really fine art to be had. I mean, your pieces are really exquisite, you know. Well, I know that your time is short. You have to get the gallery open. So I'm going to congratulate you once again. I'm sure you have no plans to retire from all of this, right? You're going to keep going.
Yeah, no plans. The thing with, you know, is if people ask me about women and art, and like I said, I read tons of biographies, that you have to live long enough and keep working long enough, and then people start paying attention to you. You look at the female potters and stuff that are really well known. They're in their 80s, 90s. Yeah. and my mom's family all lived for four generations back. They've lived into their 90s. So, hey, I'm going to keep ticking.
Okay. That's good to hear, Audrey. Listen, thank you for your time. I very much appreciate it. And hopefully we'll get a chance to see you in person at some point in time.
Okay. Thank you. And thank you for your time this morning, too.
You bet. Take care, Audrey. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
The Portage Hill Gallery features not only Audrey's work, but the work of many of the region's visual artists. The gallery is open in the winter on Saturdays from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. You can call 716-326-4478 for any further information or additional hours.
Gauguin's Impressionists Masterpieces from the Oudrupgaard Collection presents the works in the collection of Wilhelm and Henny Hansen, Impressionist masterpieces which they collected in the early 20th century. Wilhelm and Henny Hansen collected works by Monet, Sisley, Pissarro, Renoir, but they also collected works by their precursors, like Corot and Courbet, as well as masterpieces by Gauguin.
The Art and Architecture series at the 1891 Fredonia Opera House features visually rich documentaries about major art exhibits across the world. The next presentation in the series is entitled The Danish Collector, Delacroix to Gauguin, and features Impressionist masterpieces from the collection of Danish businessman Wilhelm Hansen at Oudrupgaard, his summer home. With me to talk about this collection and the Impressionist era of art is SUNY Distinguished Professor of Art, Alberto Rey. Well, it's great to welcome back Distinguished Professor of Art, Alberto Rey. Alberto, welcome once again. Good to have you back.
Great to be back. This is a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to talking a little bit about Impressionism.
Yes, indeed. Impressionism, we're getting this, masterpieces from the Oudrupgaard, I believe. I probably haven't pronounced that right, collection, but it's an interesting backstory on that collection. And I think that this particular series coming out at the Opera House is going to be pretty fascinating to anybody who likes Impressionism. My wife is a big Impressionist fan, and I know a lot of people are probably at least passingly familiar with the Impressionist movement. But, you know, so that we can get some audience prepared for going to see this particular documentary, can you just give us some idea of how this movement, this Impressionist movement, all came about, like what led up to it?
Well, yeah, you know, nothing happens in a vacuum. So one of the things that was kind of interesting up to this point was one of the major developments that led up to it was the invention of the tubes of paint, something you never would have thought of, but it was originally invented in 1840 by a man called Paul Rand, who actually used to put the paint in syringes, glass syringes, and then he was able to work outside plein air painting. And then after that, William Windsor, the name on Windsor Newton paints, came up with the metal tube with the screw top. Now that allowed painters to actually go outside and paint. And even Monet said that, Renoir said that there wouldn't be any Impressionist movement if it wasn't for the tube of paint, because everybody, all the artists had to make up their own paint. And so consequently they were tied to their studios, but this allowed them to go outside. And that also kind of enabled the Barbizon School to get started. The Barbizon School was a kind of predecessor of the Impressionists, which was less classical, more real life interpretation of art, which was also what the Realism School was kind of happened at the same time as the Barbizon School. Barbizon was mostly pushing to go outside to plein air. Realism was everyday life. What is important? What is beautiful about everyday life? It was kind of stepping away from the classical, from the rich, from the elitist. And this was, you know, bringing it down to, you know, everyday people and making that part of life important in art. And after that, because this was such a revolutionary concept, and it led, you know, as part of a much larger thing that was happening socially, a lot of social change was happening. One of the things that was also led up to the Impressionism was a whole new way of looking at light, the physics of light. You know, one of the things that happens when you paint is painting is a subtractive process. And what that means is when you mix paint together, it's less bright. So the more pigments you add to each other, the muddier it gets. Light, if you mix light together, like colored light, like in a theater production, the more light you put in, it's an additive process. So the more light, the brighter it is. And instead of getting more color, you get less color because it becomes brighter and brighter and brighter. And again, paint is subtractive. So one of the things that they realized was they could make paintings brighter, more intense, more saturated by putting colors of paint next to each other. Instead of blending them, they could put them next to each other. And then as you move back, the paint, that color would blend together because of distance. And that way you could use intense color and you wouldn't be losing any of the saturation, any of the hues that the painting had. And so what it led to was the idea that you're interpreting life, light, color in a whole new way. And it was more about how you felt about the environment than photographically interpreting what it was you saw. And this was really controversial. I mean, the public was fairly hostile about this idea. Monet, the guy that we, you know, think we all, you know, he must have been really loved. He wasn't. I mean, even in France, nobody cared about his work. Nobody liked his work. It was the Americans who first started collecting his work. And they would come over and buy just multiple pieces to take back. And it wasn't until much later that the French government and the French public that started to appreciate his work. So it's pretty interesting.
Well, I think that guy that this documentary is about, his collection, Wilhelm Hansen, actually got all of these paintings for very little money,
yeah,
simply because Impressionism in his era was not appreciated.
Right, right. Yeah. And that you know, if you want to read a great book, it's called The Mad Enchantment by Ross King. I just listened to it a few months ago. I like to listen to actually the history of art history while I'm painting. I find it like I'm connecting to these artists. It's kind of fun. But anyhow, it talks about Claude Monet and what a character he was, and that he had a couple people that really supported him in France that kept him painting even during the war. And that, but the government, you know, they weren't willing to support a lot of, he wanted his own museum that he got much, much later. But they weren't willing to pay for what he wanted or make a museum the way he wanted. He wanted a round museum to hold his water lilies. And they just weren't willing to pay that amount of money at the time. It took much later. Now it's much more, it's a beautiful space. But he also went blind towards the end, and it was talks about, you know, the surgery that they used to do back then and the glasses to correct the surgery. It's a fascinating story.
That sounds like an interesting listen for sure. What was it like to be in Paris at that particular time, the 19th century? It seems to be a very fertile era for painting, particularly in Paris.
Right. Yeah, I think there's a lot of, one of the things that I think a lot of people think is that things start and end. So one of the things, if you look at Sargent, who's a famous American painter, if you look at his paintings, they look super realistic, but when you come up close, it's just broken down brushwork, very loose brushwork. So the idea of going from something like that to Impressionism isn't a big jump. So it's just a stylistic interpretation that more people thought that this would be interesting. And even after Impressionism, what we think ended, it never ends. I mean, it's still going on today. So, other things just become more popular or more important. But these kind of streams of consciousness in painting continue. It's just, other things kind of filter in and get more attention, but things don't necessarily stop. They just become less, they get less attention, less notable. But I think during that time, he had a lot of different artists, a lot of different things happening. Paris was the center of the art world. New York was coming shortly after that. But there was a lot happening back then. You had, Degas, Renoir, Pissarro, Manet. Sargent would come over and paint with Manet. We don't necessarily think of Sargent as an impressionist painter, but he would paint outside with Manet. And so I think it was a lot happening in society, a lot of questioning happening. This is post Industrial Revolution. So a lot of, there was a lot of money moving around, a lot of support. A lot of it was fairly traditional. But, there was a lot of interest in looking at things differently socially as well.
Well, as a non-artist myself, it's one of the things I really like about Impressionism when I see it is just that the sense of, a lightness in the brush strokes and the vibrancy of the color. And I think that something about that kind of lets me think that, coming from that Industrial Revolution and moving into this new era, the keynote seems to be expressing so much more freedom in the work that you can do. I just think that the Impressionists seem to be that point where, people were breaking away from very rigid conventions and getting a little bit more free with their brushstrokes, with their use of color, and all of that kind of stuff.
Right, absolutely. I think that every artist, we sometimes think of Impressionism as the idea of Pissarro or Monet, these kind of soft paintings. But I mean, there's a lot of different artists with a lot of different styles that were classified under Impressionism. Again, like Gauguin, if you look at Gauguin compared to Pissarro, a completely different style, but it's just a different way of interpreting your environment, taking risks. If you look at a lot of Manet's work, I think one of the pieces that I think is going to be in the series is this landscape, and it looks very, very unfinished. And to do something like that at that period in art history was just scandalous. The idea that you would just put, a couple squiggles of paint in one area for the sun or the moon, and another squiggles for a reflection, and everything else would be washed out, kind of brushed loose paint. what had to be just shocking. I mean, people were just, I'm sure, would say, well, this, you know, this person's not doing any, this is just trash. But, you know, we see it now as wonderful, but it's because we've seen a ton of it. You know, it's, we've seen decades and centuries of interpretation. And so it's a very kind of commonplace for us. But if we were to see what was happening back then, like super realistic work that was super tight, and then you have something like this, you would think, well, this person either doesn't know how to paint, or is taking an easy way out, or is trying to pull something over on the public. And that's kind of what everybody thought. It was only a small group of supporters who saw the potential, how this was different, that this interpretation was different than anything that had happened in the past.
Yeah, I do find impressionistic painters very exciting. I remember, I think it was in a Monet exhibit that I went to up at the Albright Knox one year, and it was just, I remember being stunned for the, you know, first time seeing a lot of Monet's work, late work, I think, live. But it's really amazing to see it live. But I think this HD documentary is going to be great too. I did manage to find a trailer, and it looks quite interesting. Do you have a favorite amongst all these various painters?
You know, one guy that I came across, I've seen his work before, but I saw a series of his work at the museum at Yale, is Whistler. And I hadn't really paid much attention to him in the past. You know, I've seen his work, but they have this series of night paintings that are super subtle, just incredibly beautiful. There's not much to them, but there's a beautiful emotion. And again, the guts to do something like this at that period was just astounding. And again, some of my, of course, Monet's work, and, you know, again, Sargent. I mean, all those people I enjoy. But there's something about those pieces by Whistler that I just find really compelling. And again, Water Lilies by Monet, you know, that you can see those in New York. But one of the things that's kind of interesting also is what happened after Impressionism. You know, it doesn't get a lot of attention, but there's the Fauvist movement. And that is like Impressionism on steroids. Huh. It is just super colorful, super intense, just really out there. And it doesn't get a lot of attention, but I think it's even more exciting because it's just so how far they pushed the Impressionist idea to just use really exciting combinations and interpretations of color.
Yeah, it's always like, you know, there's always, you establish a movement, and usually towards the end, there's always a collection of people who are trying to push that to the max, the absolute max, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And sometimes that produces the most exciting work. Right. You got anything going on?
Me? I got a show coming up at SUNY Oswego in March with a new book that's coming out on the Oswego River. And then I have a exhibition in February at SUNY Adirondack in Queensbury, down by Lake George. Mm-hmm. I'm showing my extinct birds and my iceberg paintings.
Oh, good.
And then I got two big museum shows next year that I'm a little freaked out about. One is on the Niagara River for the Castellani Museum in March. And the other one is on the Battenkill River for the Southern Vermont Art Center, also in March. So I got two big solo museum shows happening at the same time. So I got to do at least 20 new 6-foot paintings by then.
20 new 6-foot paintings in 1 year.
Yeah.
You're going to be a busy man, Alberto.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm stressing out already. I got to do a lot of research before that. So that's kind of what I'm doing. I'm reading a lot of books. I'm reading the history of Niagara Falls. I'm reading, also listening to a new book on just came out, actually, The American History of Cuba, completely unrelated, but I just find it fascinating. There's a lot to do.
Yeah, good. All right. Well, listen, thanks a lot for your time, Alberto. I'm going to let you go. And I know we'll be doing this again sometime because it's a great time for both of us.
All right. Great. Thank you. Have a great day.
Thanks. Bye-bye. You too, Alberto. Bye-bye. The Danish Collector, Delacroix to Gauguin, will be presented on Saturday, January 22nd at 1 p.m. at the 1891 Fredonia Opera House. This is the only screening, so hopefully you have your tickets or you haven't already missed the date. If you're as big a fan of the Impressionists as I and my wife are, you shouldn't let this one pass by. Here's a look at some other upcoming arts events between January 19th and February 1st. The cinema series continues at the 1891 Fredonia Opera House with two films. The first, Ghostbusters Afterlife, tells the story of two children growing up in the Midwest who discover they have a secret connection to the original Ghostbusters in New York. Ghostbusters Afterlife screens on Saturday, January 22nd at 7:30 p.m. and again on Tuesday, January 25th, also at 7:30 p.m. Also from the cinema series comes the remake by Steven Spielberg of the timeless musical West Side Story. The Romeo and Juliet storyline is retold through the eyes of two New York City gangs fighting for control of their turf and the love that blossoms between two people from opposing sides. West Side Story will be screened on Saturday, January 29th at 7:30 p.m. and again on Tuesday, February 1st at 7:30 p.m. Not to be missed on the big screen. The Live at the Met series presents its next opera, Verdi's Rigoletto, on Saturday, January 29th at 1 p.m. One of Verdi's masterpieces, the opera tells the tragic story of a father who inadvertently contributes to the death of his beloved daughter while trying to shield her from the advances of the amorous Duke of Mantua. Bartlett Scherr directs this towering work set in 1920s Europe with Art Deco settings. If you're looking for a day of outstanding music and storytelling, consider pairing a view of Rigoletto as a matinee with West Side Story later in the evening on January 29th. Finally, the Marian Art Gallery opens its first exhibit for 2022 with its annual student showcase. This exhibit, consisting of juried selections of student artwork by the Faculty of the Visual Arts and New Media Department at SUNY Fredonia, is open now and runs until February 13th. Gallery hours are available on the Rockefeller Arts Center website. For further information on the Opera House events, you can call 716-679-1891 or hit up the website at www.fredopera.org. For Rockefeller Arts Center events, call 716-673-3217 or go to their website at www.fredonia.edu/RAC. The visual artists that create the costumes and scenic elements in a play or opera are often not thought of as visual artists as such. Once a play has completed its run, the various set elements are either destroyed or placed in storage to be repurposed for another show. But in their own right, sets, props, and costumes can be visually creative and wonderful works of art that can stand on their own as such. Just recently, the Patterson Library in Westfield opened an exhibit of the scenic work of students and faculty from the Department of Theater and Dance at SUNY Fredonia. Hyla Stellhorn, the gallery coordinator for the Marian Art Gallery in the Rockefeller Arts Center, took it upon herself to install this exhibition for the Patterson Library in their Octagon Room. Once again, it's great to have Hyla Stellhorn on the show in somewhat of a different capacity. Hello, Hyla. Welcome.
Hi.
So I found out very recently that you are responsible for a new installation at the Patterson Library, and it's an installation that will display a lot of work from the various designers who designed the sets and costumes and so on at the Department of Theater and Dance at SUNY Fredonia. So why don't you give me, let's start from the beginning. How did you decide to get this together?
Well, there's a small art gallery in the basement of the Patterson Library in Westfield, and it's called the Octagon Gallery. And Nancy Nixon Ensign runs it. And a couple of years ago, Nancy is an artist, and she also used to do set design in New York. And she said, I've always wanted to do a theater arts exhibit, you know, with behind the scenes, like set design, costumes, renderings, because she knows there's a lot of art involved before you even see the finished product on stage. And we had 3-year lead time. So I figured, yeah, sure, this sounds great. And then like kind of, you know, the pandemic hit. And so, when it came time to do this exhibit, I thought we would all, like all of these, my friends who do set design and props and costumes, I figured I would ask everyone for work and people would dig stuff out of their closets and offices and hand me a pile of like, you know, brilliant old things. But what happened was when I put out the word and asked people, like, what do you have to share for this exhibit? Everything that came in was very current. And looking at it all, I realized that it was demonstrating like the arc of theater from 2019 to where we are now in 2022. And we actually have this very poignant collection of like how theater kept going during COVID. Mm-hmm. So one of the first show, like there's a model piece from 2019 by the scene designer at SUNY Fredonia, Zertan Lim. And it's Beauty and the Beast at Syracuse Stage. It was pre-pandemic, huge musical, 16 different scenes. And then the pandemic hits and like everything comes to a grinding halt in the theater arts. And then like slowly you see through this exhibit, like shows picking them, people picking themselves back up and saying, we're going to continue making theater no matter what. So the next show that's represented is also by Zertan Lim for Syracuse Stage, and it's Tally's Folly. And so it was done in April 2020. So pretty soon after everything shut down.
Right. About a month. Yeah. And it's a two-hander too.
Mm-hmm. So they picked a couple, a married couple, so they didn't have to worry about quarantining. And they did a fully staged production of this very endearing show and filmed it, streamed it for audiences to watch at home. Cool.
Yeah, very cool. Very
cool. You know, think of all the people who are employed for that, like, you know, directors, stage managers, costume designers, technicians, set designers, painters, props people, like everyone was getting back to work. Mm-hmm. I just thought it was brilliant. And then we have another show, a student show that was done last fall of 2020. And it's She Kills Monsters, which is a stage show that was rewritten to perform virtually. So the one that we have on display is She Kills Monster Virtual Realms, where the playwright took their play and rewrote it to be done via Zoom. So the Department of Theater and Dance at SUNY Fredonia continues producing. The set designer had to design these pop-up backdrops to go in everybody's dorm room. The play itself is about Dungeons and Dragons kids.
Interesting.
And so all these costumes have like a very DIY aesthetic. So they're made out of found materials and cardboard and tissue paper, zip ties, parts of Coke cans. Like it's very inventive.
Wow.
It's really creative. Every actor sat in their bedroom or dorm room in front of their laptop. They had their own background. They had their costumes. And they did a fully staged production via Zoom. And then the gallery also has like some recovery COVID productions where we all came back this fall and we're like, we're doing it. We're going to mask, do it as safely as we can and just continue to make art. So part of this exhibit, there's some things from The Wild Party, the set design that was the first big musical from SUNY. Also done by a student. And then my favorite part is we did the Hillman Opera, did a fully staged opera fall 2021, and everyone just wore masks. And it was The Secret Marriage. And we took the set and the costumes and we actually installed everything in 1/3 of the gallery.
Wow. So
we painted the walls, we installed columns, windows, just dressed the set. So you can kind of walk into the gallery and experience what it was like being on that set.
Oh, that's fascinating. So the all of these elements from the set, props, costumes, all of that, it actually exists in one corner of the octagon. Is that, that's what you're telling me, right?
Right.
Wow.
Well, it's four walls.
Okay. Four walls of the octagon. Okay. So that's a fascinating exhibit. How long did it take you to put this all together?
I think it all happened in 4 days. I also have a regular job, and it didn't happen alone.
Right.
My husband, who's the technical director at SUNY Fredonia, so he builds, constructs, and installs scenery for a living. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't have happened without him. A snowstorm hit while we were installing, so we were like pulling scenery out of his truck and walking through like 12 inches of snow.
Oh my!
Into the library. And then we had some students come last week and just help with the installation. Cause like I was doing it by myself for a while. And I was like, I feel like I'm putting on a show, but it's lonely. Wow. Usually when you do a show, like everyone's coming together, like
right.
You've got painters and props people and costume folks, and everyone's milling around and we're all creating it together. And I was installing like everyone's pieces and I was like, oh, like I miss like the energy and the vibe that comes from putting it all together. So some students, I put out like a SOS, like, you know, help, like let's come together. And they responded and they came, and we had a great day. We got it all done in 4 hours, and they all came to the opening, and it was super fun.
Oh, great. Well, you know, this is just another example of what you do as an artist. I mean, you have your day job. You're the gallery coordinator over at the Marion Art Gallery. I know that. So that's your artistic side. But this merges it with your theatrical side, your set designer, construction, all of that side. You managed to merge the two sides into one exhibit this time around.
Right, right. All these parts of my life kind of came together. But it's really all thanks to Nancy at the Octagon Gallery. It was her idea, and it was fun. It was a different experience.
How long is the exhibit up for?
So if you want to see this exhibit, you can come into Westfield. So you can spend the whole day there. It's such a charming little village. It runs through February 4th.
Mm-hmm.
And the gallery space is open like throughout the week. Mondays and Wednesdays from 10 to 6 p.m. Tuesdays and Thursdays, it's open till 8 p.m. Mm-hmm. And Fridays and Saturdays are hours as well. So,
okay. So it's readily accessible. Any COVID restrictions or anything like that?
Everyone wear your mask.
Wear your mask.
All
okay.
Do our best.
Yeah. And it's actually a pretty easy space to social distance and all of that kind of stuff. I'll probably bet that if you pick a nice time to go, you might have the place all to yourself for a tour of that exhibit.
Yeah, absolutely. And the gallery, or the building itself, the Patterson Library, is like an architectural jewel in of itself. It was built by Hannah Patterson, who was a single wealthy woman in Westfield, to honor her parents, and they spared no expense. Columns, carvings, marble, Tiffany light fixtures. Like, it's really a gorgeous building.
Oh, good.
So come for the exhibit. Stay for the architecture.
There you go. Yeah. And read a book while you're at it. You know, I mean, it's all there for you to do. Listen, as long as I have you on the line, you got a sneak peek for the Marion Art Gallery coming up?
Oh, sure. The upcoming show at the Marion Art Gallery is, right now it's Fredonia Showcase, and it actually opens this Tuesday. If you want to see a lot of me this week, and it's kind of like, it's curated by the art professors from the visual arts department. And they, like, the kids do projects for their classes, and they kind of pick the best of the best. So there's graphic design, some really good sculpture paintings, these amazing large scale charcoal portraits. And it's very diverse. So you can see kind of what everybody does in the art department. It's all student work.
Oh, good. I always like to come and see what the students are doing. Sometimes they're so evocatively creative, I find.
Agreed.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad I caught you on the fly, Hyla. I know it was sort of an unexpected interview here, but it's good to know. And I wanted to make sure that people got a chance to see this sort of emerging pre-COVID, post-COVID theater must go on exhibit at the Patterson Library. I think it's good to for people to, you know, continue to keep the idea that we're trying to keep things moving forward, we're trying to keep things alive, and that's really important for us all.
Yeah, thank you so much. I'm glad that you heard about it and spread the word, and thanks for having me.
Oh, you're welcome, Hyla. Well, I'll probably be talking to you another time, I'm sure. Take care.
You too.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Setting the Stage, Design for Theater, will be on exhibit at the Patterson Library's Octagon Art Gallery in Westfield until February 4th and is open during regular library hours. Further information can be obtained through their website at PattersonLIB.org. And that's it for this all-art edition of Notes from the ILC. My thanks to Audrey Dowling, Albert Hooray, and Hyla Stellhorn for being my guests on this episode. Notes from the Aisle Seat is a production of the 1891 Fredonia Opera House in Fredonia, New York. For more information on any of the Opera House's events, call the box office at 716-679-1891, visit the website at www.fredopera.org, or email at operahouse@fredopera.org. Notes from the Aisle Seat is now available wherever you get your podcasts, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. If you like this podcast, please consider following us by clicking the follow button on our website and spreading the word through your social media feeds. If you have an arts event you'd like featured on the podcast, why don't you drop us a line at operahouse@fredopera.org, and we'll see about featuring your event. Please try to give us a month's advance notice, if possible, to facilitate timely scheduling. We'll return in 2 weeks on February 2nd, 2022, with a new episode. I'm Tom Laughlin, and until then, be safe out there, and be kind to one another.